Okay, welcome to MLA's podcast on the environmental impact of a healthy diet. I am Veronique Drillet. I am the Senior Nutrition Manager at Meat and Livestock Australia. And today I am talking to Dr. Julie Hendry, who is a research scientist in the Human Health Program of CSIRO, and Dr. Brad Rittout, who is Principal Research Scientist from CSIRO's Agricultural and Food Division. Together, their research has generated a unique and important body of evidence on the environmental impact of the Australian diet. In our previous podcast, we discussed some of the key findings. Brad, are you able to recap where we left off?
Yeah, hi, Vero. It is such an important topic because so many people are talking about sustainable diets nowadays, and there's so many what you call, I guess, simple answers being promoted. You know, eat this, don't eat that, and, you know, solve all the world's problems sort of thing. But, you know, it is more complex than that, and I'm worried that some of these simple solutions could do more harm than good. We do know that a lot of diets that are low in greenhouse gas emissions are also lacking nutrients and high in sugar. So in previous podcasts we did together, we talked about the complexity. Of course, diets, we need to have room for diversity. Not everyone wants to eat exactly the same way as everyone else. Not everyone wants to eat exactly the same foods every day of the week. We need diversity, and diversity is encouraged in our dietary guidelines and is an important principle of nutrition. But at the same time, environmental impacts are complex as well. You know, we hear a lot about biodiversity. We want to also protect the climate. We want to protect water resources. And then there's other environmental aspects as well. And improving all these things simultaneously is not as easy as some people might have you believe. Now, we've been working with a set of real dietary intake data from the Australian Health Survey, and we've been looking for diets that are both healthier and also have lower environmental impacts. And what we talked about last time was that, yes, we find in this big group of more than 9,000 diets, we look for those that are better, and we do find that a lot can be done to improve the diet quality of Australian diets. But actually, there's only so much, only a moderate improvement can be made in the environmental impact side of the equation. Probably something in the order of around 15% improvement, because these different environmental objectives don't always reinforce one another. Sometimes they're fighting against each other because of the different production systems used to produce the different foods that we eat. So really what the main message from last time was that we need to do a lot in terms of improving the environmental friendliness of our food production system, but there's only so much that can be achieved through dietary change. And we shouldn't try and overstate it, I guess.
Thanks, Brad. I think the one thing that I think was really fascinating about your research was this notion of trade-offs, that a lot of the research looks at greenhouse gas, which is very important, but there are so many other environmental indicators to think about, and that they don't always go in the same direction. I know you've already looked at a few environmental indicators, and since we spoke last, you've looked at more. Can you explain a little bit about this notion of trade-offs and why is that so important?
Yeah, sure. Well, in the previous work, we looked at three environmental indicators: the climate impact, the water scarcity footprint, and also the cropland demand. And cropland's important because of its relationship to biodiversity conservation. Many scientists internationally are concerned about the expansion of croplands, because that sort of overtakes the space for natural environments and biodiversity. But not always, you know, you have some foods might have a high water footprint and a low greenhouse gas footprint, or a high cropland demand and a low greenhouse gas. You know, not everything is low, 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 or high, high, high. And that really is borne out in the latest work we've done, where we've added a fourth type of environmental impact, which relates to pesticide toxicity footprint. When pesticides are used in the food production system, some of that pesticide, it goes into the soil and into the environment and has environmental impacts that are undesirable. And what we found there is that the food group that had the heaviest contribution to the pesticide toxicity footprint of the Australian diet was fruits. Now, that would make people from the nutrition community alarmed, because, of course, we should be eating more fruits and a greater diversity of fruits. But, you know, fruits are maybe low in greenhouse gas emissions. Some of them are high in water footprint, some are low in water footprint. Some are high in pesticide toxicity footprint, some are low in pesticide toxicity footprint. But overall, you know, it's hard to achieve multiple objectives all at the same time. It's like anything you're trying to do in life. If you're trying to do one thing, you can go far if you focus on achieving one thing, but then you leave all other goals aside. But when we're trying to make our diets more sustainable, we're trying to make them healthier, higher diet quality, and then we're trying to improve all these multiple environmental dimensions at the same time, and achieving multiple objectives is very complex.
So really that makes it very difficult for a consumer to be able to be confident knowing what food is sustainable, because it's really hard to find a food that ticks all the boxes.
Well, I think that's why there's a lot of these simple messages floating around that are either cherry-picked messages or use a portion of the evidence. And a lot of the information out there is not even based on evidence or evidence that's relevant in the Australian context anyway. So that's where we're trying to support the Australian society by building up this evidence base relating to the sustainability of actual eating patterns in Australia.
Which comes to you, Jilly. Nutrition is another important variable that needs to be considered in a sustainable diet, because we don't just want our diets to be good for the environment, we want it to be good for our health too. Can you just explain how you've been working with Brad to really understand how can we make diets that are both good for the environment and good for our health?
Yeah, so Brad and I have done a lot of work together looking at this question from different angles. Some modelling that we've done within CSIRO, again, using the National Nutrition and Physical Activity Survey, which is our most representative dietary intake data that we have, even though it's 10 years old. So we wanted to look at understand various ways Australians eat, so using these actual dietary patterns that exist in the population, and compare this to our Australian dietary guidelines and the pattern that's promoted in those guidelines, as well as to another set of global dietary recommendations that have received a fair bit of attention of late, and that being the planetary health diet. For this particular modelling, we examined these different dietary patterns and looked for or thought about patterns that might be perceived to be healthy and perceived to be of a lower environmental impact. So sometimes these concepts of health and sustainability, because they're both really complex in their own right, are thought about sort of in a more one-dimensional way. So, you know, a healthy diet amongst Australians might be one that has the most vegetables or has the least discretionary foods. And then a diet that might be thought to be environmentally sustainable might be one that is thought to have the lowest meat consumption or the lowest dairy intake. So we compared these single focused dietary patterns to one that is considered higher diet quality, so an overall dietary pattern that complies as close as possible to the Australian dietary guidelines. Interestingly, the best of what we had in Australia still only scored 60 out of 100. So we're a long way from a perfect diet, but it's the highest quality diet amongst Australians. And we focused on adults aged 19 to 50. So we looked at all these various dietary patterns and we compared their food group composition, the nutrient adequacy relative to the nutrient reference values, and also their environmental impacts using these range of metrics that we've developed with Brad, as well as the overall indicator score. What was interesting with this work was that when you take this single focused approach to a healthy and sustainable diet, it doesn't necessarily mean that all other aspects of your diet fall into place. So if we use the example of, you know, the group of Australian adults who had the most vegetables, so they had a bit over 5 serves per day, which meets the dietary guidelines, they still consumed too much discretionary foods. They didn't have enough whole grains. On the flip side, those who had the lowest discretionary food intake, on average, they didn't eat enough of the healthy core foods. So you fix one thing, but it doesn't mean you fix everything else. What we found with this work actually was the Australian Dietary Guideline was the dietary pattern that was most nutritionally adequate, followed by the group of Australians who had the highest diet quality. So, and again, remember these groups, they weren't perfect, but they were the best of what actual Australians are doing. In terms of environmental impacts, though, the Australian Dietary Guideline diet had a far higher environmental impact score than the Planetary Health Diet, but it was lower than all of the existing current dietary patterns that we looked at. So essentially, we concluded that the Australian Dietary Guidelines is a dietary pattern that can be healthier and also have a lower environmental impact than how most Australians are currently eating.
That's so interesting, Jenny, because a lot of people seem to imply that there is, you know, that eating sustainably is about making certain choices over the others. Whereas from what you're saying, it might be portion guidance, eating the right amount of various foods that we eat in the diet might be one of the single most easiest ways for us to reduce our environmental footprint, because we might need to eat a little bit more of some foods, so that will increase our impact. We might need to eat a little bit less of other foods, but that might not offset the impact of eating more of other foods. So are you suggesting we might need to think about portion guidance of all foods?
I think, firstly, that whole of diet. So, you know, sensible dietary recommendations recommend a range of food groups, variety of food choices within those food groups. And then to achieve those targets or those recommendations, we need to put together healthy meals that are comprised of healthy foods in appropriate portion sizes. So it does come down to composition of meals and portions of foods that we eat within a meal and across the day.
Excellent. Now, we all know how hard it is to follow a healthy diet. I mean, we all know what we've got to do, but we don't do it. So behavior change is hard. When you do your modeling, how do you take that into consideration? How do you think about how one might turn these nutrition recommendations into day-to-day life? You've indicated that's important. How are you thinking about that?
I actually think that's so important, it needs its own project. So we've, you know, through this modelling, we've worked out how far we are from various sets of recommendations, how far different groups of Australians are from the recommended dietary patterns. But I think it takes, you know, another piece of work to understand how to translate that into practical guidance. So we know that, you know, nutrition recommendations are only going to be as good as their level of adoption. So we can make all the recommendations in the world, but if people aren't able to action them, they're not going to realize the health and environmental benefits of those recommendations. So we need as many people as possible to adopt them, so that they can have that benefit in their day-to-day life. I think, you know, dietitians, you know, best place to give that practical advice. And the advice really needs to be realistic, actionable, graduated advice that supports people to shift from where they are slowly towards a pattern that is more healthy and more sustainable. They're not, most people aren't going to get there in one big leap. Changing too much tends to mean we don't maintain those behaviours. We haven't built up those habitual behaviours around adopting this new dietary pattern. So step-by-step graduated actionable advice is really, I think, another piece of work that needs to be done to support Australians to shift towards a recommended diet, a more healthy and sustainable diet.
So very interesting and so consistent with the work we find, you know, the findings we find when we test our practical resources. The ones that resonate best with consumers are really those where they go, oh, this is really easy. I'm doing this already. and I'm guessing that's what you are suggesting as well. Brad, which comes to you back, you know, this whole notion of we want to inform choices in a way that is not misleading, but that is, you know, making it easy and not misleading is actually quite difficult because the area is so complex. So I guess we do need to, people are worried about the environment and they do want to make a difference. What sort of things can you suggest people can do right now based on that evidence?
Well, I think it's important that people don't get swept away with gimmicky type messages. I mean, one of the fundamental things that people can do, which would make an enormous difference, would be to cut down on food waste. And the best information we've seen about food waste come from a very detailed survey in the UK that found that a third of the food people were buying, bringing into their home, ended up being thrown into the bin. Now, there's been all sorts of surveys done in Australia too, none is representative, and it's very difficult to get a complete quantification of food waste because some goes in the bin, some, you know, loses moisture content if you weigh it afterwards, some things go down the drain like surplus milk and liquids and things like that. But we can pretty safely assume that we're probably wasting a third of the food that, you know, on average, that we comes into our homes is never eaten. Now, you know, when people are confronted with these statistics, you know, they usually say, oh, no, I don't waste any food. We never waste any food. No one sort of is necessarily conscious of wasting food. No one sets out to waste food. I mean, it's a waste of money to start with. But we're all wasting food without proactive intervention, being more mindful when we're shopping, how much we're buying and the portions we're cooking and eating leftovers and using things up fully and this sort of thing. You know, no one's saying we're going to reduce waste to zero, but if a third of the food we buy we're throwing away, that means a third of the environmental impacts from the food we're purchasing is just going straight into the bin. And when you look at it like that, I mean, It's horrifying. It's a major area where people could make a big difference without worrying about, you know, giving up this or swapping that or going to other complicated things that could actually end up complicating their diet quality or compromising their nutritional adequacy to begin with. But it's not a sort of sexy topic, food waste. No one's really, you know, making a lot of money out of it. So not a lot's being done. It's not, I don't believe people are as conscious of it as maybe they're getting other messages about foods that they ought to be avoiding or this or that, or some new product that they should be buying. But really that's the first thing people could be doing to make a major impact on the environmental burdens of the food that they're purchasing. And let's remember also, this is not food that's wasted at the farm level where the farmer might plough it back in. The environmental impacts are minimal. This is after all the growing and all of the transportation and packaging and often processing and retailing, and then eventually you bring it to your own home, you store it in a refrigerator, and then after it's wasted, it goes into a bin that a truck has to come along and collect and take it away for disposal. So, you know, when we waste food at our home level, it's the most serious form of food waste of all because, you know, unless you're composting or something like that and retrieving some sort of value out of it, it's wastage of all the environmental impacts all the way along the supply chain and then some more in the process of disposing of it. So food waste is not much talked about, I don't believe, but it's a big one. And the other thing, of course, and Jilly's already touched on it, and I don't know if the message came across as clearly, but our environmental impacts of our diets go up the more food we consume. The more dietary energy we consume is associated with total environmental impact. So if we're overeating food, that's inflating our environmental impacts as well. And what leads us to eat more dietary energy than we need, adding to our waistlines, it's a lot of those discretionary foods that are high in energy. If you're eating a lot of energy-dense, nutrient-poor foods, it's very difficult to not overconsume food and energy. So therefore, you're exaggerating your environmental impacts from your diet. So it's reinforcing the need to be eating more of those foods that are high in fiber and high in protein so that we can sort of get off the those discretionary foods that are very Moorish.
Yeah, it's a little bit like we've just got to learn to make every bite count so that we're eating the foods we need to be healthy without wasting foods we don't need to eat. Jilly, how can dietitians, that's pretty much what dietitians need to do, don't they? What are the three things, based on all this research you've done, you've spent so many hours looking at this and thinking about it as a dietitian, what do you think people can do to eat? What are three things? You know, we love three things. We can remember that. What are three things that we can tell people to do to be not just healthy, but reduce the environmental footprint?
Yeah, I think dietitians are the best place to give that practical guidance to actually support people to change their behaviour, so change their dietary habits. Dietary guidelines are there as the foundation, but in some work we've done recently reviewing dietary guidelines around the world, we found that that practical, actionable advice was the bit that was mainly missing when health and sustainability was spoken about in dietary guidelines. So this is where I think dietitians come in to support people making that behaviour change. So I think our advice to patients or clients really needs to be realistic. How can people adapt what they currently do slowly to get to where we want them to be? So, for example, in our modelling that we just did, we found that about 30 to 45% of Australian protein choices is coming from red meat and poultry, and legumes are making up less than 5% of the average Australian's protein choices. So if we're recommending a drastic shift in those preferences, it's really going to change a lot of how we prepare meals, and we're going to have to have a real shake-up, which might be more difficult for people to achieve. So a dietitian's really there to help people sort of make that stepwise change in meal composition. Another way, I guess, we can shift this balance. So we've spoken about overconsumption of discretionary foods. We need to have more vegetables. And how do we sort of make this graduated shift towards that? And that's probably looking, at the portion size. So getting the balance right, buying and eating foods in appropriate amounts. You know, again, using the national nutrition data, we find that Australians have three main meals a day and on average two snacks. So we need to get the most out of these main meals. We tend to have most of our meat and vegetables at the evening meal. So we've got this one occasion that we need to achieve, you know, five serves of vegetables and our protein. So we need to have large portions of vegetables at that meal. I think when Australians eat vegetables, they actually consume them in an amount that is half of what is recommended. So we only have half a portion of vegetables each time we have them. Whereas discretionary foods, we tend to have three or four times the recommended serve every time we eat them. So we've got to get those portions right so that then our meals become healthier and our overall diet can become healthier. So, and I think the final thing, Brad's probably covered it really well, is just to eat to our needs. Anytime we eat too much food, you know, we place ourselves at risk of unnecessary weight gain, and also dietary energy is associated with total environmental impact. So, yeah, eating to our needs, portion size, and making our dietary guidelines really practical and actionable for people to actually change their behaviour.
Thanks so much, Brad and Julie. The work that you've done has been amazing in terms of providing us at MLA with directions on how we might produce resources that are really helpful to consumers. It really is an important piece of work and really points us in the direction towards providing portion guidance around healthy balanced meals where red meat consumption is consumed in amounts recommended in the Australian Dietary Guidelines. And anybody listening to this podcast can read about some of the research that Brad and Julie have conducted, where we've listed some of those references and also the nutrition resources that we had, that's been inspired as a result of this research. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Vera.